You can influence the state of your nervous system in the moment, and then in the long term with consistent practice, you can change the pH of your blood. You can change the brain waves in your head. You can basically change the feelings you have, the emotions you have through changing your breath. If we can learn to lower our baseline stress levels, we'll be more resilient to stressors, and that can be really, really beneficial for everything. Honestly, it just helps you become more you. You learn about yourself. It's really like meditation or mindfulness, the same principle as you hear from the renowned teachers. It's just about becoming more you.
Welcome to Mindset, Mood, and Movement, a systemic approach to human behavior, performance, and well-being. Hello and welcome. I am joined today with my dear guest, Nick Heath, who is the breathing diabetic. That is an intriguing title, and I know you're going to want to listen to this. So Nick is a specialist in breath work. He's a type 1 diabetic. He has been working with his own condition and breath work, which we will get into and uncover the story, and it is fascinating. But Nick has also been working alongside NASA. Now, I'm super privileged to have Nick come join us today to talk about breath work, his story. And I think if you're interested in everything that we cover on this show, which is how we function best, blending our mind, blending our breath work, bringing the body together, Nick's going to give us some good insights. Nick, welcome. Good to have you on the MMM podcast.
Thanks, Sal. Appreciate you having me here, and looking forward to chatting.
Nice. Thank you. So I think the first thing I'd love to get into is, well, you're a diabetic. Let's just go from this. And you call yourself the breathing diabetic. Now, how long have you had diabetes? What type is it? And can you just give us a little understanding? Because I know there's type 1, type 2, but could you just expand on that for us, please?
Sure, yeah. So I've had type 1 diabetes since I was 11. Type 1 is the autoimmune version, where basically your body attacks your pancreas, the beta cells that produce insulin, and you can no longer make any insulin. So you're required to either take injections or wear an insulin pump basically for the rest of your life until they come up with something better. So I got that when I was 11. I'm 36 now, so I've had it for 25 years with type 1. Type 2 is more of a metabolic dysfunction. There's a lot of things going on that cause insulin resistance, and that can basically lead to either needing medication or in some cases also needing insulin injections. And then there's a few other types, but those are the two primary ones, the type 1 and type 2. So I've been type 1 for over 25 years, which is a long time. The breathing diabetic, that's where that came from. Just basically with practicing different really simple breathing techniques and practices that improve my blood sugars, improve my sleep, improve my mood, and all these things, and trying to understand that. This was about 6 or 7 years ago when I started, and when I found some research that was like, oh, this stuff actually does seem to work for people with diabetes, I decided I needed to share it. So when I started out with all of my breathing work, it was really to help people with diabetes, because I thought, this is crazy. It's helping me so much. I want to share it. And then like many people who become fascinated with the breath, it's like blossomed into just an overall obsession with understanding breathing and trying to share that with the world.
Amazing. Thank you. And thank you for being clear on the types of diabetes, because if you don't have it, of course, type 2 is quite lifestyle orientated, generally, and metabolic. I know for myself, so I'm very interested in how the whole human system works. I know a lot of my listeners are interested into fitness or moving towards good fitness. And of course, metabolic health is fundamental. It's easy to think about the movement stuff and the metabolic and the food and forget the breath. And I've heard this a lot from perhaps people in the nutrition world. They're all about nutrition, and that's wonderful. And yeah, no one's talking about how breath and that regulation of your biochemistry and your neurology, all of those pieces go into this. But I would love to know more about NASA, because I'm a boy. Well, I'm quite an old boy now, but I, of course, like a kid, grew up watching spacecraft and these cool dudes in America doing amazing space things. And you've been part of NASA. So tell us more about that story.
Well, that's that was in a previous life. So that wasn't breathing related. This was just in atmosphere. My PhD is in atmospheric science, meteorology specifically. And in the past, I've been fortunate to to work at, on some internships with them, studying weather and clouds and air pollution, actually. So a whole nother part of who I am that's not really related to the breathing work at all. Sorry to disappoint you, Sal. I don't want to bum you out, but it's really just a part of my life. I do this for love, for passion. I really think this is really important. But my upbringing, my academia, all my professional life has been in atmospheric science and studying thunderstorms and pollution, and that's where that work was. So I've been very blessed to have projects with them and get to experience some of that. But I'm not associated with them in any way. It's just been through, you know, like internships and things. It's been, again, very, very lucky.
All right. Good to know. Although I would add the, you know, pollution and air pollution is a big problem. Most of the world, really, there's pollution everywhere. And air isn't pure. Those of us who care about the breath and what we breathe in. Yeah. I mean, air pollution is sort of a segue from where we're going today, but it does need understanding. But clearly you have an academic rigor and understanding. And I think this is so interesting, because I came at breathwork from a yoga background. And of course, there's a lot of breathwork in yoga. Some of it's esoteric, some of it's more meditative. Sometimes the breathwork in yoga, in my experience, is not science-led. There is some science in it. There's more ancient science. But of course, we've got really up to date with, you know, Wim Hof has been a big proponent in the field. Of course, you and I have trained through Patrick McKeown. You're probably far more advanced than I am with Patrick McKeown. And all of these more science-led approaches, there's a lot of gravitas to it. Perhaps you could share with me, because you have that academic rigor, what is it about the breath work that you're doing now and the academic understanding that you have that really tells you that breath work is what we need to be doing, and perhaps better understanding?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there, but really, I mean, I guess it just starts with what breathing is, right? Breathing sustains our life. It's literally how we get oxygen, which is so crucial. And understanding that, because it's automatically happening, you and I are breathing right now, everyone listening to this is breathing, it's part of our autonomic nervous system. And so it's part of this functioning that occurs, like our digestion, like our heartbeat, like everything, that just to stay alive. But for some reason, nature gave us this ability to control it. And that is where the power of it becomes real for us and so important. Is because we can control it whenever we want, essentially, most of the time, not during sleep, of course. But, and that gives us kind of this, the best word people use, remote control, whatever we want to call it, to our nervous system. And it allows us to actually influence, not like directly, it's not like, you know, instant gratification or anything, but you can influence the state of your nervous system in the moment. And then in the long term, with consistent practice, you can change the pH of your blood. You can change the brain waves in your head. You can basically change the feelings you have, the emotions you have, through changing your breath. And so today, you know, there's lots of science out there. And that's what got me so excited about sharing it, is that, you know, I was seeing journals like Nature Scientific Reports and, you know, legitimate journals publishing papers on how, you know, slow breathing can reduce oxidative stress, or can maybe perhaps help with inflammation. And probably most rigorously is the mental health side of things. Like, how can it reduce our stress levels, which then we know has downstream effects on basically everything, like, you know, physiology, like inflammation, but also our moods and our, you know, our enjoyment of life, our satisfaction, our connection with the world, with other humans, all the things that make up like a fulfilling lifestyle. And so, yeah, it's been kind of fun getting into it about 7 years ago, and seeing now I see papers all the time, you know, and we're getting more rigor in the science. So it's not just that there's papers, that they're actually getting, you know, it's making it much more challenging for breathing to see, like, oh, can it pass this test? Like, there was recently a really neat one that basically put it to the ultimate test in some fashions. And in any case, so it's been really fun to see. And basically, it gives us a tool to change our mood and to change our physiology. Each of us will respond slightly differently. but it gives us a way to change our body and mind instantly and over time. That is cost, you know, it costs nothing. You just got to learn the proper techniques. And so there's really just no better option out there from my perspective. Now, of course, there's tons of other, you got to eat well, like you got to move. You were just talking before this that, you know, you do a lot of different things, right? There's not just the breath, but without the foundation of just good breathing, it makes everything else a lot more challenging.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it's what I've seen. So in the field of psychotherapy, moving into the field of mindset coaching, been teaching yoga for a long time, and then into more, let's say, science-led breath work, and then into also strength and conditioning training and actually learning in that whole field. What I see is that we really need all pieces. Now, I have there is a bias towards the field. So you got your fitness people, you might have your breath work people, you got their mind people. And often they're not talking. And what I see in human performance and just well-being is they're often disparate fields. But if we go back to basics, there's some non-negotiables I see, which is if you don't have good sleep, you need to fix that. Otherwise, everything will crumble. If you don't have healthy, effective breathing, you need to fix that because everything around that will crumble. And then you can sort of nuance out. Then it's the physiology of your body. If that is working well, like you're moving well and you're exercising enough that's right for you, then you're going to be in a good space. And I see so many people come on with challenges, you know, which I work with in the mental space. And I ask them the question, like about the physiology, but I'll observe their breath work. Are they chest breathing? Are they belly breathing? You know, do they, so that's a sighs. And that's something I hear in, I use co-working spaces sometimes. I hear that going on. I'm like, what's going on with this person? They're audibly demonstrating their stress levels. And they're not regulating their breathing patterns. And thereby, are they regulating their mind? Well, I'm not talking to them. I don't know. But what we know is that they probably aren't. Now, I want to cycle back because at some point you weren't a breathing specialist diabetic. How did you get into this? What brought you into this breathwork world? What was it? Where were you before and what got you into this?
Sure. Yeah. It's very, very distinct for me. So I got into the idea of it when I, thought about this a lot now, like what led me here? And it was, I did get interested in yoga, in, you know, 2013 or 2014. And that opened my eyes to the more holistic stuff, but then it was Wim Hof. So Wim Hof was getting on all these podcasts and I was listening to him and I thought, you know, he's got all this charisma and it's really he pulled me in. My personality said, oh, this is awesome. I became like a fanatic with Wim Hof. But with time, I noticed some changes in my body. Who knows if they were related to the Wim Hof? I don't, you know, everyone works differently with different methods. But I became a chronic mouth breather. That was a big problem. And it was because it's not that Wim Hof says breathe through your mouth all the time. It's that I was taking the principles of the method and applying them to my everyday breathing. So I was walking around huffing and puffing and I was drained. I mean, I got to a point where I was taking naps in the afternoon almost every day, just not feeling myself. And at that point, I discovered Patrick McEwen. I heard him on a podcast, and this was the first time any type of like science came into my head of like, oh, because Patrick starts citing all these studies and saying, oh, we need to breathe through our nose. We need to balance our carbon dioxide levels and, you know, the Bohr effect and all these really cool things. And I thought, oh, this actually makes a lot of sense. So I taped my mouth that night. I was driving. I think it was a Sunday. It was either Saturday or Sunday. I was listening to the podcast. I stopped at the local pharmacy, bought some paper tape and slept great and thought, this is wild. And a few days later, I had so much energy. I was at work, just like I had no afternoon crash. I felt great. And that's when I started thinking there's something to this. So I started doing the light breathing. I got into slow breathing at that time. Patrick wasn't a fan, you know, he was just about the reducing volume, but I was doing that. And then I started reading papers it took about 2 or 3 months to notice like significant changes in my health where I was like, this is crazy. My blood sugars are better. My stress levels are better. My mental health is better. I'm sleeping better. And it was all from just changing my breath. And so that's when I started reading papers and became like obsessed with it. Now, and it's like, I try to be very realistic about everything. Like I was probably a unique case with the mouth, just mouth breathing all the time. Whereas most people cycle, you know, but I was like always huffing and puffing, and everyone responds a little differently. But for me, that mouth tape like changed my life. And so I thought, I got to understand this, and found that a lot of people experience this, and there's actually a lot of cool reasons why and things like that. So that was, I guess, my origin story of going from like just a normal human to like being obsessed with breathing.
Cool. Really interesting to hear. And I've done with Wim Hof's practice. I'm a big fan now. I think he's a charismatic individual. He's brought breathwork to the masses. As with anything, we can get caught up in this is better, that's better. I don't think it's helpful. I think we need to understand that there's many versions of breathwork. You know, if you go to a Kundalini yoga practice, they do very different ones, and there's many, many ones. Of course, Wim Hof is often that big breath. I know Patrick McKeown is really on the lighter, more gentle, slower breath. I would just say that if we don't understand the conscious manipulation of breath, whichever version you do it, then you are missing, like, as you already said, a fundamental tool. And for listeners who have got this now and thinking, well, that's all very good, but we breathe all day. You're right. It's about 20,000 breaths a day, approximately, is a human cycle. So this is happening so much and so often. So if we talk about minor dysregulation times 20,000, you know, we're talking about negative compound interest of negative effects. And the flip is the same. It's like compound interest in, you know, breathing health, that if your breath is better throughout the day for, let's say, that 20,000 breath mark, you are going to continuously get gains and really good experiences. And I work a lot with emotional regulation, like neurological, psychological emotional regulation. And I say to a lot of people, because so many people say to me, oh, I just want to calm down. Isn't that what regulation's about? I'm like, not really. Regulation's about being in the right state at the right time. Whether you're flow state neurologically, like you're out, you're socially engaged, you're zoned in, you're in a fight state, like you're moving towards challenge, but with effectiveness. You're in a flight state. If you're in it consciously, you're moving away from the problem, but then there's a shutdown state. Now, interestingly, of course, the breath and the vagus nerve feeds the signals up to the brain and talks, you know, body to brain, brain to body, about where we're at. What I've noticed is that often we've got a lot of, something I see in the fitness world or the active world, a lot of big breathing and then crashing. And it's interesting to hear what you said there about that, you know, the mouth breathing and crashing versus the more, let's say, well, we call it regulated, but controlled breath. Now, let's understand this, because we need to understand, how on earth does it regulate blood sugars? Because we're talking about neuroregulation, right? We've kind of alluded to that already, and we can go more. But tell me, how does it work with blood sugar? How does that actually work in your experience so far?
Yeah, so most of it's indirect effects of stress, from what I've understood, and then changes in the nervous system. So when you lower your perception of stress, not even the actual stress you experience, right? Just how you perceive it, it changes your complete physiology, right? And that's going to have major impacts on everything we do. And so just from that perspective, and anyone listening to this who has diabetes of any kind will know, when you're stressed, you have a bad dream even. You wake up and your blood sugar's high because the sympathetic nervous system releases, you know, these stress hormones like adrenaline and things, which actually contribute to insulin resistance, on top of releasing more glucose into the bloodstream to aid you in that fight or flight response. So if you can bring down that state of your nervous system, it's going to help with everything, right? And so blood sugars is just one of these byproducts, and it happened to be the most noticeable for me at the moment because it's so obvious. But by lowering stress, you reduce activation of the sympathetic nervous system, and then this just has a bunch of downstream effects that help with blood sugar management. And, you know, a big one is actually the emotional regulation. So it actually turns out to be a lot of like mental changes you get that help with the blood sugar regulation. But at the same time, you know, there's now really a lot of research showing that it lowers oxidative stress. So when you slow down your breathing, breathe at optimal volumes, you're increasing the activity of the parasympathetic nervous system. And this seems to have a natural antioxidant effect. So this can be really helpful for people with diabetes. And then another interesting one is improving blood flow. So when we are, you know, relaxing, loosening up those blood vessels, letting the blood flow through it smoothly and easier, this can help with the insulin delivery and just help with a lot of complications associated with diabetes, because diabetes tends to stiffen our arteries and, you know, excess oxidative stress and inflammation tends to essentially make blood flow really challenging. And so it's helping there. With all that said, you know, there's actually a lot more, and we can go into more if we need to, but really, I think from everything I found, a lot of it is really the psychological, and the way it will show up for each person will be a little different. But that is kind of what's so nice about it, is because you mentioned the vagus nerve, and we talk about like the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system. These have connections to everything. These connect to your entire body. And one of my teachers, Eddie Stern, he likes to say, you know, basically when you bring the systems back into balance, it'll help whatever you need help with, because it's targeting everything. And so when you just reduce the sympathetic drive to that one organ, right, or that one area, it seems almost like magic, but it's really just your body being able to heal, because you're giving it time to do what it's meant to do, which is to relax in between these stressful situations. And so with diabetes specifically, it seems to do, you know, something with just right to help maintain the blood sugars. A lot of it is the stress reduction. Some of it's probably blood flow. Some of it's like heart rate variability and reduced oxidative stress and lower inflammation. And altogether, it's like the culmination of a bunch of benefits helping out.
Lovely. Thank you. Really, it's a really clear explanation. What I'm hearing there is this, what I talk about in my work with sort of ecosystemic approach, that we can go into a mindset of reductionist, which is quite a Western, you know, European, American idea, that, you know, let's go to the cardiologist for the heart problem. Then we're talking about the biochemistry. Okay, those of you who don't know, emotions are biochemicals. They are literally little molecules that float around the body. They have ligands. They've got keys that lock into things in the body and the brain. So basically the whole chemistry set of our body is, I'm visual, Nick. So what I imagine is a bit like one of those fish tanks. So my dad used to have a fish tank. And you got that fish tank, and he used to put in these kind of cool little ornaments and flower plants, and then he'd bring his fish. It's a little like every time you put a different fish in or a different color dye in the water, it's changing what you're seeing. And our body is this huge chemistry set with thousands of things going all the time. If you change the breath, you are influencing this flow and effect of whatever the chemistry is, the biochemicals, and then the whatever is going on in the biography, the psychological piece. It's, for me, it's about that understanding of it's influencing more. And perhaps a little like the weather, right? You know, I live in the UK here, and it's not that nice at the moment. Like, that influences everything from your mood to, you know, what you wear, to all these different things. So breathwork is, I think, fundamental in my experience of emotional regulation. But it's so interesting to hear how it's having this metabolic / glucose influence approach on everything that you've said there. It's just fascinating, isn't it? Now, with that in mind, I'd like to come to the point of, well, it's all very well, and I get this from people who don't know breathwork. They're like, well, I'm breathing anyway, so I just relax a bit. And it's like, no. It needs to be a bit more nuanced than that. What strategy tool have you used as your main go-to tool for a breath pattern? Because there are many, and this is, I think, where people can get confused if they're new into this space. Do we go Wim Hof? Do we go Patrick Kuhn? Do we free dive? You know, what do we do? What's your main protocol or breath practice that you're doing now that you find is right for you and with specifically with a diabetic condition?
Sure. Yeah. So the first thing is to start with safety, right? Like, what can't hurt you? That's where I always start, because there's so much out there. Right? You just mentioned there's so many patterns. Should you try this and that? So it's like, start with what can't hurt you and what's shown the most effective results in the science and across, you know, millennia of practice, like you alluded to, the ancient yogis were using this stuff forever. And that comes back to just simple, slow breathing. So when we say slow breathing, that technically refers to any rate below 10 breaths per minute. But usually it means like between, let's say, 4 and 6.5 breaths per minute for most people. The average breathing rate, gosh, is like, I think the range now is like 12 to 18 breaths a minute or somewhere in that range. So it's a pretty big span. But so you're reducing your breathing rate in half or even a third of what you're doing at rest. And so when you do this, basically what it does is it synchronizes signals between your breathing, your nervous system, and your cardiovascular system, which brings it into a state of like coherence or resonance is the word we most frequently use. And that tends to give us a lot of benefits. And basically, it tells your brain, you're safe, things are okay, you can relax, and that lets the body's healing response occur naturally. That's, you know, Harvard physician Herbert Benson discovered this a long time ago, the relaxation response, has written, you know, countless papers on it and all his books and all of these things. And essentially, breathing just gives us a real simple way to activate that, to put your body into a healing state that it's meant to get into. And so for diabetes, it's slow breathing at a rate between about 4 and 6.5 breaths a minute. I usually recommend starting at 6 just because it seems to be comfortable for most people. In through the nose, out through the nose, or if you like, in through the nose and out through pursed lips. It depends on what's comfortable for you. If you're just starting out, a lot of times going through the pursed lips is easier. So you start there with where you're at and then build up to, you know, in and out through the nose. Each has a little bit different effects, but they're both really, really helpful. I usually recommend a slightly longer exhalation. So like 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out. And it's that easy. You do that for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes a day. If you're up for it, you can do like two 20 minute sessions is usually about the maximum people need, maybe in the morning and the evening. And that's really, it's so simple. It's almost ridiculous because I don't have any secret techniques. I don't have any crazy formulas. It's like, just do that, consistently. That's the key, consistency, and you'll feel the changes. I'll mention a few others though for people with diabetes. Like I always promote alternate nostril breathing. That seems to have really good impacts on our brain, our memory, and our ability to retain motor skills. And it's also calming and relaxing. So alternate nostril breathing is a good one. In short bouts, some humming can be nice just because it's very relaxing, activates that, that vagus nerve and can be, real nice. And then learning to breathe through your nose all the time, not we're talking, I'm mouth breathing right now, but, here and there, but breathing through our noses as much as possible so that we get all the benefits of nasal breathing, as much of the day as we possibly can. So those are kind of the really nasal breathing and slow breathing are the two I always recommend. And then those others are extra.
Yeah, lovely. It's so interesting. It's almost like my go-to as well. I'm pretty similar with those choices. I've learned a lot of techniques with the yoga discipline, with Patrick McEwen's discipline, but my preference is a 4-6 if I want to regulate. It feels really manageable. I know there were some studies done on 5.5 breaths per minute was the mean, and that was over both Western and Eastern principles. But I think, again, unless you're more advanced, don't get caught up in like which one's better, which one's more accessible. I love what you said there about safety, because we pretty much know in the field of psychology, the brain's code one is threat detection. It is not built for having a nice, you know, day, relaxing, enjoying yourself. No, its first job is a security mode. It's designed to like, okay, is there a threat? And in modern world, most of our threats are actually psychological. And ironically, there's more of them. If we were to go back, you know, 100 generations and we were hanging out in a, I don't know, savannah or something like that, there's obviously threats about predators. But, you know, once you're chilled out, you're good. But in our world with constant stimulus, there is constant threat potential. And I think this is what I'm seeing with some of the people I've worked with, that this constancy is quote-unquote the problem, because stress in itself is not a bad thing, right? It just isn't. Stress is a response to a set of variables and signals that you're receiving. Do you let it go? And I wonder if you've got some science, because I've seen a bit, but I can't recall where I've seen it. But if we are continuously stressed, that it shifts the baseline, like our stress levels goes up higher. So rather than we get stressed at you know, a whole bunch of work stuff, one thing comes in and we find we're stressed. Have you come across any data on what that baseline shift is?
Sure. I don't know if I can recall like a specific study on the baseline shift. I can give you I'll give you an example, because I think it feeds into what you're saying, is people with diabetes. So when we look at people with diabetes who, if we measure them physiologically, so like heart rate variability and something else called baroreflex sensitivity, and both of those are kind of indicators of your cardiorespiratory health or cardioautonomic health, and in general can be related to stress. So usually higher heart rate variability means slightly lower stress. It means you're more parasympathetically driven. And same with the baroreflex sensitivity. If you're higher is usually better and lower is usually worse. So with those, we see people with diabetes, when we measure them at rest, they're typically lower than controls. And what are we under? A lot more stress. We have a lot more emotional stress, making choices. Our body's under physiological stress from blood sugar fluctuations, and the things we talked about earlier with, like, you know, less arterial flexibility and things. And so we see it show up in the data that when you're living with a chronic disease, these markers of health, of vibrancy, of stress resiliency are all going down over time. And usually the longer you've had it, the more decline you see. So definitely, I think it just makes intuitive sense. And there is some data showing that the more stressed you are, the more, you know, the higher your baseline. And the interesting thing, and this is an analogy, I think it was in The Mindfulness Solution by Ronald Siegel. And he says, you know, imagine, you know, you've had a great morning, you did your breathing, whatever it is, you know, you go out, you leave, you have a great conversation with your partner, you go off in your day, and you get in like a pretty major car accident, but you're okay. Your first response might be like, oh, I'm so lucky, like I made it, everything is just damage, it'll be okay. Then he says, now think about another day, you wake up, everything's going wrong, you're stressed, you get in a fight with your partner before you walk out, and then you're driving and you get rear-ended, or, you know, something real minor happens and it throws you over the edge and you blow up, right? And it's like, it was such a tangible real world example of that baseline stress level that you were alluding to, that when you are in a calmer state, you're more resilient to stressors. So you need, like you mentioned, stress is good. We need that stress, not a car accident, but we need stressors, and you're more resilient to get hit with them though, and then come back to baseline. Whereas when you're always being stimulated all the time, checking, you know, the news or whatever it is, for each individual, and then you get hit with even a minor inconvenience can throw you over that ledge, and where you just kind of go off the rails, or you have an emotional spiral, whatever it might be. And so intuitively, it just makes sense that if we can learn to lower our baseline stress levels, we'll be more resilient to stressors, and that can be really, really beneficial for everything. I went on a little tangent there, but I hope it was helpful. It's a fun little story from that book.
That's super interesting what you're saying there about all the stimulus, all the factors that shift our baseline. And it's really easy to forget just how stimulated we are. I think one of the tells is when we go on holiday or take a break and put down everything, and finally, after some period of time, you think, oh, I'm actually relaxing. And I think of the car alarm analogy. You know, unfortunately, car alarms seem to be ubiquitous and pointless. I don't know what they're for anymore, but a car alarm can go off and off and off. And it's only when it stops, you go, oh, God, it was really loud, wasn't it? Because then you hear the silence. And yet we don't hear the noise in our nervous system. We don't hear the noise in our mind because there's so much going on. And yet you make such a good point about that baseline. And I want to touch another point that you said, which was about chronic conditions. Now, I too have a chronic condition. I have an autoimmune condition called ulcerative colitis, which means my immune system will attack part of the colon. Sometimes it's specific, sometimes it's general. And this is a 40-year journey I've had with it. It started when I was 13 years old. It has a basis in trauma, interestingly. And looking at work from Dr. Gabor Mate, and he's, you know, big voice in this field, that most, not all, but probably most autoimmune conditions have a trigger and a traumatic experience. And that seems to be what happened in my story. And what I found is, of course, chronic stress, chronic inflammation because of this condition, it's a big part. And it's easy to think about diabetes being, oh, well, I don't have diabetes, I'm fine. But actually, if we have any chronic condition, we are likely to have chronic inflammation and chronic stress. So breath work and breath control is actually fundamental for almost anyone with a chronic condition, in my view. Now, I'm also not a medical doctor. It's an opinion as opposed to medical guidance. But that's what I found in my own experience about when I'm in a flare-up of the condition and I'm in trouble, you know, I'm ulcerated, I'm hurting, I'm struggling, that calming everything down, getting into that state of rest and repair, as you've alluded to, absolutely necessary. And it's really... breath is one of the tools you can use that is not medication. You know, you don't have to go to anyone for it. You simply need to practice it. So I want to also then speak to one last point you said about we can do a breathwork session for a period of time a day. And I think that's brilliant. And I love to do that myself. What I worry for many of us is we could do a dedicated breathwork session and then breathe awfully for all day long. And I want to speak this because it's a bit like the fitness thing. Like, you might go to the gym for an hour, go do a run, but if you sit down for 12 hours, it's out of balance. Now, how are you helping people deal with this regular? How do we breathe better all day as well as a dedicated practice? What are you doing with that to help individuals shift perhaps the way they breathe and the way they understand it?
Yeah, so lots to unpack here, and you had so many other things I kind of want to touch on, it's really nasal breathing is the biggest one. And then the other word I try to use is quiet. And to me, I've heard lots of words, and that one is the easiest practically. So nasal, quiet breathing most of the time, and that's it, right? It's so simple that it's almost ridiculous. Of course, you want to be breathing more through the diaphragm, either your belly or your lower ribs slightly moving. You want like this 360 expansion. From my experience, that's a lot harder than just saying, hey, breathe through your nose and breathe quietly. And that seems to help the most people. And at that same time, an interesting thing, and I kind of regret not saying it earlier. I wish, you know, when you said which practices are your key, you know, a big one for me is mindful breathing. So not necessarily controlling my breath, but just using it to check in with myself, both during my formal practice. So during my sitting, you know, in the mornings, I do mindful breathing for quite a bit, but also throughout the day, because it gives, like you talked about it, we've talked about, it's like, it's showing us so much about our body. You said, oh, you know, I'll work with people and I'll be watching their breathing. And once you learn to watch your own breathing, it becomes this like revolutionary idea, because you're like, oh, I'm not okay right now. Something's wrong with me because my breathing feels restricted. I feel a little tightness. I'm yawning more, or I'm sighing more. And I catch myself doing these things and I think, well, what is going on in my life? Something is triggering me and I don't even know what it is. Actually, a lot of times it's how I notice blood sugar changes. Like, I'll start feeling a little tenseness and a little bit of restricted breathing. I'll say, I think my blood sugar is getting low. Along with the other physiological changes, it confirms it, but that's usually the first one I notice. And so teaching people to tune into their breath, to understand their emotional state and what may be in their environment or the email or whatever it might be that may be causing them stressors can be really helpful. So it's like, breathe nasally, breathe quietly, and then use the breath when your breath isn't that. Not to get mad at yourself. Let's not get mad at her. It's not blame. It's not that you stink at breathing and you just got to breathe the way, you know, Nick says, and then you'll feel better. It's like, no, use it as a tool to kind of understand your body and maybe think, oh, what is going on that could be causing this? And why am I breathing like this? Is it that it's something with my job? Is it something in my house? Is it, you know, an actual stressor? There's so many things that could be triggering it. And it just gives you a tool to tune into that with yourself and understand your situation, maybe not even change it, maybe go with it. Like you said, it's not about being, it's it being appropriate for whatever the stimulus is. And so using that tool to tune into your body and mind is a wonderful thing we can do without feeling like we're not good enough. And like a lot of health people try to make you feel, you know?
Yeah. The phrase came to my mind, it becomes a barometer of your state. It feels like it, from everything you said there, it becomes a barometer, and it's not right or wrong. It is. And then you can get interested in like, oh, wow, I'm really shallow breathing, or I'm kind of quite tense as well. What's that telling me? As opposed to, that's wrong, I should be, you know, Mr. or Mrs. Calm, or yeah, let me change that. As opposed to, oh, that's, you know, I have a whole thing around signals, symptoms. People hate symptoms, you know, oh, get rid of my symptoms. Like, well, but symptoms are signals. And if we use that signaling to say, oh, well, I'm carrying some tension right now and I'm kind of a little bit upper chest breathy. Interesting. This, and I'm doing this particular piece of work with this particular person. That's quite telling, because I was really chill earlier on with the other piece of work and the other person. So it can give us good feedback to do something. And I love what you said there about making it nasal, nice and simple, right? Just switch to nose breathing. And the second thing, make it quiet. Because if it's quiet, it's controlled, it's gentle, it's smoother, it's considered. And the very act of observance means you're going to shift it, right? So that's a lovely, simple thing. And I do that, not with anything, right? There's so many nuances in the fitness field, in the psychology domain, in the breath. There's all these specialisms, but I think the fundamentals, get the blocks right, get your sleep organized, get your body moving, get your breathing steady and regulated. So much is going to go right for you. Like so many things are going to go right for you, as opposed to worrying about, is it a 5.7 breath? And did I do it for 12 minutes? Like, just going to get it together. Really, really interesting. I'd like to also get your thoughts around breath and movement. I don't know if you move much, if you do integrate movement. I know I do, and I find it interesting. Is there anything you're doing with breath and movement at the moment for yourself or for your people you're working with?
So the biggest one for me personally is walking. I'm a huge fan of walking, and if someone didn't know me, they might think I'd be the walking diabetic and not the breathing diabetic, because I probably spend more time walking than anything. But with that, I do. So you can integrate breath walking where you count your paces with your steps, and that's beautiful because it's like it's breath work or whatever you want to call it, breath practice. I guess meditation, because you have to stay concentrated. It's a focused, and it's physical exercise. So it's almost like this beautiful combination of everything. And that can be really nice. There's a whole book on it called Breath Walk. There's some videos out there. There's a lot of different things, but really it's like find a comfortable inhale and exhale with your steps. Maybe it's 5 steps in, 5 steps out, whatever it might be for each person. I do that some, but nowadays I really just focus on nasal breathing while I'm walking. That's my biggest one. And then I like to listen to books or do whatever with that, but that's the biggest one. And then using the breath. So with people who I may work with or talk with or that are more athletic than me, that get out there and really, get after it, using it to cool down, like in between, like coming up with simple things, like maybe if you're going all out for 30 seconds or something, don't worry about your breath, just do whatever it does. But afterward, let's come down quickly using like the shift adapt. They have their gear system, where you go from like, mouth to in through the nose, out through the mouth, to in through the nose, out through the nose. Like you kind of bring yourself down gradually to recover, or just using the breath after your workout to kind of like reset, like to kind of just, lower some of that oxidative stress and basically have a little bit better recovery after the intense workout if it's needed. But for the most part, yeah, I'm mainly just walking, nasal breathing, and sometimes breath walking and counting my breaths.
That's super interesting, Nick. Well, I do a lot of fitness. I do a lot of activity, and I have found that, and I'm amazed that when I'm in a gym, I see people breathing terribly sometimes, a lot of mouth breathing. It's fine. I mean, I do like the HYROX style training where we do a run and then we do like a heavy push or heavy carry. I like that strong stuff. It's fun for me. People say, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm having a great time. And mouth breathing is absolutely right. You might need to do that. So there's nothing wrong with mouth breathing. We don't want to get caught up, but it's a tool. Like, are we using the right breath at the right time? And I think you made such a good point. The down regulation. So when I finish my strong strength practice or run practice, I will slow everything down. I'll probably go do some yoga style posture work to not only release, but to down regulate. But I'm always slowing the breath, because I know if I've gone peak on it, because exercise is a stressor and it's a controlled stressor, but then bringing it back down helps just balance everything out. And it feels like if we understand the breath is both a barometer of where we're at and a tool to change where we're at, it becomes this sort of multifaceted information and understanding, and also becomes an actual tool that we can change things. That's why I love doing it. And I find that if we're doing psychological performance, you've got to have some form of breath control. And if you're doing physical performance, you've got to have some form of breath control. It's like it goes right in the middle. It's right there. Cool. Now, I would like to get your final thoughts on, and perhaps even if there's a little breath takeaway we can do for, I'm happy to be experimentee. But if there's a little breath practice you'd like to take us through, I know people who are listening, I've done it myself, but is there a breath practice that you would like to share with us that you could take us through that we can just get a real litmus test of it now?
Sure. Let's see. typically I use like some tones, you know, to make it guided. But okay, let's do alternate nostril breathing. That's a nice one.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So the first thing you'll want to do is get the, oh gosh, Shunmukhi Mudra. Let me make sure. Yeah, I might be wrong. Let me see. I don't want to embarrass my yoga teacher. I'm sorry, but I'll just say, let's do this. Let's take your pointer finger and your middle finger and place them against your palm. And then we're going to, yep, there you go. You're going to use your thumb for your right nostril and your ring finger for your left nostril on your right hand. Yep. And so we'll, let me guide it once and then I'll have you join in. But basically, you'll start by blocking the outside of your right nostril. You just press lightly against the soft cartilage. You don't need to push it down too hard and you don't need to plug your nose. Just softly press it down and exhale through the left. And then you'll inhale through the left, switch, and then exhale through the right, inhale through the right, switch, and exhale through the left. So the way I like to think of this, because it can get a little confusing, and that's actually what's good about it, is the cognitive demand, is if you imagine ancient times or modern times, and we just reverse the breath cycle. A lot of times we think of an inhale, exhale, but a lot of cultures thought of exhale, inhale, you know? And me, this is Nick's thing, not anyone else's, that not like in ancient science or anything, but I like to think give before you receive. So exhale before you inhale. And if you do that, it becomes really easy. You just take one breath on the left, one breath on the right. Exhale, inhale, exhale, inhale. One breath left, one breath right, one left breath. And so it's real simple. No complicated thoughts there. So we'll go ahead and do that together. So take, index and middle finger against the palm, right thumb blocking your right nostril. Exhale through the left. Inhale left. Exhale right. Inhale right. Exhale 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 left. Inhale left. Exhale right. Inhale right. And exhale left. Now just release your hand down and take a moment to tune into your body and your mind. You might notice that you need to take one or two bigger breaths or that you just feel really calm. Just check in and see how you feel. That's it. It's that simple.
Really nice. Yeah.
You could do that longer, but you know, a couple of minutes is good.
I felt that real sense of left and right side of my body at level. I had a very clear kinesthetic sense, particularly in my head. There was like a real clear sense of left and right in balance, not sort of particularly leaning to my right side or left. It's very apparent. I know some people are less kinesthetically connected and that's okay if you don't get it. But for me, I felt that left and right part of body and particularly my face was like, it feels completely connected. I feel both of them. Yes, thank you. Nadi Shodhana, I believe it's called, isn't it? Yeah. Amazing. Cool. Well, Nick, you are clearly a font of knowledge, and we're going to put your details in the show notes for people who want to follow Nick's work and a lot of the science that you've kind of put up. We could have gone mad crazy into the science, but I think, I don't know about you, Nick, but for me, make it practical, make it useful. That's what makes the difference. And the science is lovely. You're clearly a science person. And you know it's good. You know it works, and you've got your own direct experience, which is amazing. So, my dear listener, I hope that you will be nasal breathing. You will be quiet breathing. Perhaps you'll take that alternate nostril breathing practice that we've just done and maybe play that out. Obviously, you can replay the podcast to do it again. And do let us know your thoughts. Nick, what's your last thoughts on breath and why we should do it?
Honestly, it just helps you become more you. You learn about yourself. It's really like meditation or mindfulness, the same principle as you hear from the renowned teachers, Thich Nhat Hanh, Jon Kabat-Zinn. You know, it's just about becoming more you and not trying to be, you know, this person or this real tuned in or this calm or that. It's just learning about your body and becoming more you. And so use it in that way so that it supports whoever you want to become and whoever you already are, discovering those layers and don't take yourself too seriously. How about that? That's my favorite breathing exercise is laughter. So that's what I'll end with. Laugh a little bit and learn a little bit more about you.
Amazing. Thank you. Wise words. We shall absorb those. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sal. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I trust there's plenty to take away. As I always recommend, this is my go-to with podcasts, is that there's a lot on here. Sometimes there are pieces you want to grab. If you only listened or watched, go back, grab the bits, record it, write down notes, because action is traction. So breathe well, my friends. Until the next time, take care. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe. And if a friend would benefit from hearing this, do send it on to them as well. If you would like to get in touch yourself, then you can go to my website, which is saljefferies.com, spelled SaljeffReies, saljefferies.com. Hit the Get in Touch link, and there you can send me a direct message. If you'd like to go one step further and learn whether coaching can help you overcome a challenge or a block in your life, then do reach out, and I offer a call where we can discuss how this may be able to help you. Until the next time. Take care.